It seems Middle Eastern countries are perpetually in the news for suicide bombers, ISIS, and a lack of women's rights. But Catherine Zoff found a much more nuanced reality when she covered the Middle East for the New York Times between 2004 and 2010. I spoke with Zoff about the story she shared in her recent book, Excellent Daughters: The Secret Lives of the Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. While living and working in the region, Zoff found a wide diversity of cultures and perspectives that she doesn't think often come through in coverage of the Middle East.
I think that our news report on the Middle East is dominated by these stories of war and revolution and terrorism, and those stories are very important. But I wanted to make the case that there was diversity, there were things that were happening in the lives of women in these societies that weren't being fully seen from overseas, and that I wanted to try to share some of this diversity of views and experiences with readers if I could.
And throughout the book, you talk with and you tell the stories of women who are working for more rights for themselves and their families, as well as those who are more conservative. And one of the conservative activists that you talked with, Rhoda Youssef, I thought she was particularly interesting because she isn't who we might picture as a conservative activist.
Yes, she was fascinating. And she had a campaign in Saudi Arabia several years ago called My Guardian Knows What's Best for Me. And under King Abdullah, who died last January, women's rights had been more of a priority than they had been under other Saudi kings than they are under the current Saudi King Salman. And Rhoda was among the many Saudi women, in fact, who felt that things had maybe gone too far and was concerned that Saudi women would lose these guardians who they regarded as protection, as something that they wanted to maintain in their lives. This is something I found very surprising.
So as you talked to the women, it seemed like there were really quite a few who talked about Islam giving them their rights. And one woman goes so far as to say that that's the only religion at all that gives women rights.
Yes. I'm often asked if the reason women don't complain about that is maybe because they're afraid or because they're, I've heard the term brainwashed used, and I don't think that's true. I mean, I've come to believe that most of the women that I met were genuinely very devout, and they believed that the path to change was to be found within their religion. They were very respectful of the framework and the society, and they were working very hard to change things. And I found that very, very interesting, because I think some of us would look at, you know, a system where a woman's word in court is worth half out of a man and think, well, gosh, you've got to toss that all out and replace it before you can really talk seriously about reform. But most of the women I met would disagree.
And in talking about the women, it brings me back to the women in the beginning of the book who were just beginning to study law before women were allowed to practice.
Yes.
And so I was wondering if you've kept in touch with many of the women, if any of them are practicing, or if you have any updates from any of these women that you talked with several years ago.
I was in touch with several of them for a few years after that, but I tried to get back in touch with a couple when I went back to the kingdom in the fall, and I wasn't able to. Unfortunately, the fact is that because for so many years women were not allowed to practice law, I think women who were graduating in the first few years often didn't find law jobs and often ended up working in different professions. And that may be part of the reason I wasn't really able to find them. But now they are, and there are relatively few of them. There are only 67 of them now in a country of 27 million, but some of them are doing really amazing things.
One of the stories you tell is the story of Zahra. She was a victim of the practice of honor killing, which is something that I think gets a lot of attention here. Her case was just very interesting, very heartbreaking, but also interesting in the way that it really kind of took the country by storm.
Yes, I think by the standards of Syria at that time, it was huge news, and it really got people very, very upset. And I think part of that was just the way that particular story was moving in a way that other honor killings had not been. So Zahra, the girl you described, she was very young. I believe she was 15 at the time that she was kidnapped and raped. And then she was put into a prison for girls who had, for some reason, lost their virginity, because the government is well aware of the fact that these girls are at risk of being killed. And then her family got her released from prison on the pretext of marrying her to a cousin, and then killed her about a month later. But, you know, it was very interesting to me to see how activists working on this issue chose that case and publicized it and got religious leaders involved in talking about it. So it was a really sort of object lesson in effective activism. And this set of circumstances, that she was this young, that the family got her released, did in fact get her married, but used the marriage as a pretext to get her out so that they could kill her, really offended people. Whereas, you know, say an older girl, say a 20-year-old who had been seen in a cafe with a man, was not a rape victim, would certainly not have aroused the same outrage if she had suffered the same fate.
Have you seen in your recent reporting much change in the perceptions towards honor killing?
I haven't had the opportunity to research honor killing directly again in the last several years, but anecdotally, and through the activists I keep in touch with, I hear that it continues to be a problem and that the present upheavals may, in fact, be making things worse. Because men, maybe who are refugees, who have lost everything they had in a war, feel less in control over their own lives. And one way of sort of asserting that your status or your manhood or your values is by sort of asserting your control over the women and your families.
Was there someone or something in all of your travels and reporting that most surprised you or struck you?
Oh, gosh. It's hard to name just one. I think I'm always struck by the fact that it's not necessarily the people you would expect to become leaders of one cause or another who end up inspiring others in their communities. It's often women who were a bit shy, or in the case of a young woman who had been a solid C and D student when she was studying law, and she was just not a very motivated student. And then she met this one woman who asked her advice, and suddenly everything changed. And she said, "I suddenly realized why I was studying law, and that there are women who really need this information." It just completely transformed her life and that of many others through this women's rights education initiative that she ended up founding during her last year in college. So I'm always surprised by the fact that it's often not the very confident speakers or brilliant students who end up doing these incredible things.
That is a really interesting story. And I find it interesting that you tell the book through the stories. And I was wondering, what made you decide to write the book? And if people only come away with one thing, do you have something you want that to be?
Originally, I went to the region as a news reporter, so as a stringer for the New York Times. And, you know, this is a part of the world where most of the news that we see in the States is about these big crises, wars, and political upheavals of various kinds. And those events sort of necessarily dominate the headlines, but I came to see that change also takes place in very small ways that may not be noticed at first. And though these regions look a bit static from afar, set against the backdrop of these big political upheavals, there's actually a lot of change, a lot of progress going on. And I think if there's one point I hope to make in the book, it was to emphasize the importance of these small gestures, and that daughters making very slightly different decisions than the ones their mothers made can actually add up in aggregate to really huge changes.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. And one last question. One of the bigger changes we've seen recently, Saudi Arabia was the last country that completely banned women's suffrage, but they recently gained the right to vote as well as to run for elections.
Yes.
And I found it interesting that a lot of analysts were saying that it was a little more window dressing. How did you view the development?
To be perfectly honest, it's a little bit hard to tell. In Saudi Arabia, these elections are for municipal councils. They don't have any actual power as we would understand it. It's an absolute monarchy. The king has absolute power, and the municipal councils, which are these little sort of city councils in each Saudi city or municipality, can have an advisory role. Women can now run on them, and they can now vote for candidates. But even before this election, I interviewed dozens of Saudis about this, and no one's really sure what they do. Several people told me that after the elections, each time they're never really seen or heard from again. You know, even in the editorial pages of local newspapers, no one knows when they meet, no one knows how often they meet. And you know, I hope I don't sound cynical. Yeah, sure, it's wonderful. It's a small step. Women can run, women can vote, but we have to remember that it's an absolute monarchy.
Mm-hmm. So still many restrictions around suffrage for women.
Yes.
Thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you so much, and it was so nice to talk to you.
That was Catherine Zoff talking about her recent book, Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of the Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. I'm Amanda Hunnigfort. Thanks for listening.